Hey, everybody, it's Eric and Todd, and thank you for checking out another HatchetCast episode here on Spotify. And this is a new setup for us, but we have a special guest, a.k.a. Todd. He's our medical instructor here at Barrel & Hatchet, and he owns his own consulting company called Guardian Angel Consulting. He teaches the Guardian Casualty Response course, which we will actually have those classes here on the calendar, so go check out the website. Before we get started, guys, make sure you go ahead and follow the channel and hit the notification bell so that way you're updated about new episodes that drop, as well as subscribe to the newsletter if you want to get an update training calendar or anything that's in stock on the website. Also, check out our YouTube channel and Instagram. YouTube, we have the HatchetCast show, but that's a great way to support us and always come out and train with us, and you can train with Todd. He runs a great course. I always learn something every time we do it. So, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let's go ahead and hey,
calm down.
All right, so let's get a little bit of background. I know we've done several episodes with you before, but for those who don't know or have not listened to other episodes, can you give a quick recap of where you started in medicine?
Quick recap. All right, I'll make it as quick as I can. Started at 16 years old in high school, getting certified as an EMT basic. Enlisted in the United States Navy. Following high school, became a Navy corpsman. Spent most of my time with the Marine Corps Infantry as their medic. So you get a wide variety of things there, you know, everything from everyday sick call to deployment medicine downrange. Did a couple of deployments, got out, worked in a civilian ER for a couple of years, and then got into my current profession as a firefighter paramedic. I've taught paramedic school for the last 3 years. And I'm no longer going to be doing that because I'm going to be starting as a flight medic here soon, which I just got board certified in. So I'm pretty pumped about that.
What's something that flight medics do? I think it's something that most people know exists, but don't really know the details of what that is.
Yeah. So they are responsible for the critically ill and critically injured. So if you're flying in a helicopter, you're having a really bad day, super sick patients, or extreme trauma that time is not on their side, so they'll call a helicopter out and kind of pick those patients up. Also, your scope of practice, which is the window that you're allowed to kind of operate in as a paramedic, it opens up once you get your flight paramedic credentials. You can do things like chest tubes, surgical airways, blood transfusions, a lot more medications, and it's a lot more stuff that I was actually able to do as a corpsman. Now I can do it in the civilian side. So. You know, again, just really critically ill and injured patients requiring immediate transport.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, downrange or, you know, on deployment, you know, medevac was the key ticket out of a combat zone. So Hilo was pretty much the only way. There was no ground medevac that existed, at least for us. I don't think it existed for you. It was just the ETA was too long.
Yep.
So is that something that, you know, what are some things that are on your radar as far as things that you want to make sure that you are competent in whenever you go into that field? Some things that are, that you think would be applicable as you're training and going into that training for that job, you're like, holy smokes, this could be applicable for, you know, everyday citizens and things of that nature.
Yeah. I'd say the absolute biggest thing that, one of the biggest things that I preach in my course that I want everybody to kind of be competent in is assessment. You know, all the injuries that we go over in Guardian Casualty Response course, at the end of the day, they need a surgeon. That's the reality of it. That's what's going to save those patients. But what we can do is buy patients time, by recognizing certain things, being really good at assessing and seeing, okay, is this person improving? Are they maintaining? Or are they getting worse? And if they're getting worse, how can we get them out? Who needs to get out first? Who do we need to send to the hospital first? Everything we talk about is going to be limited resources. And I'm sure we'll get into the Ukraine thing, but resources, we can't overwhelm resources because then you have, you know, then you can't help anybody. So being able to recognize, okay, this person is more critical than the other person that we have hurt. So that's the biggest thing that I push for us outside of the skills of actually stopping bleeding and controlling open chest wounds and things like that. It's really important to just be able to assess somebody. And it's not, you know, I teach pretty basic ways of doing it, and it's not difficult as long as you're trained how to do it. So
I think that, you know, kind of just jumping right into the Ukraine thing, because the reason why I think that the Ukraine conflict is so pertinent to what we need to keep an eye on, and the lessons are, I think, going to translate well to if a conflict happened here in the States, is it's two near peer forces, right? So, like, they both have relatively the same capabilities, not because Ukraine on its own has had capabilities that match Russia, but essentially it's NATO's capabilities versus Russia's, and we're seeing that now.
Right? 100%.
So I think the lessons learned that we're seeing in the scenarios that a lot of those soldiers are being put in, you know, in that type of modern conflict are what I believe are going to happen here. Like, there's not going to be a higher level of care. If there's a civil war conflict, or if there's an invasion or something, a complete breakdown of society here, you're either going to have a hospital that has a higher level of care with limited resources, limited power supply. You know, they have to really prioritize who is going to be, you know, treated for surgeries and things of that nature. If they're being bombarded, can that higher level of care self-sustain? They may not be able to take your casualties. So, for example, one of the videos that I saw recently was a Ukrainian drone that was just observing the battlefield. They actually had an FPV drone that was attacking a Russian trench, and the drone actually dropped a grenade on a Russian soldier and, like, hit him dead, like square hit him, right? So this dude's laying on the ground in the trench in agony. You could see the other soldier trying to figure out what to do, trying to figure out how to help him, and they time-lapsed it. So it's like a good amount of time has passed. This dude's obviously suffering, and the team soldier or team sergeant or whatever comes over and just kills him, like puts him out of his misery. And that's the type of thing that's like, for the American military, that's unheard of. That doesn't happen.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
We have the resources to do that, but we're now seeing two modern forces with modern equipment having to make decisions that are almost World War I style.
I was going to say, utilizing World War I tactics, I mean, you have drones dropping bombs in trenches.
Yeah.
Like, we have to think about that for a second. Like, that's wild.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I'm just thinking, like, what is going through that dude's mind of, like, what conversations were they having in that trench of, like, okay, they've all got tourniquets, they've all got stuff to be able to provide basic stop the bleed, but that's not enough. You know what I'm saying? And now this dude is too far gone where it's not even worth trying to get him out of here because they don't have either the resources or it's not worth the risk. So those are decisions that I think are going to be things that we need to think about here in the States. If we go into a conflict, and this is why I'm always saying, like, you don't know what you're asking for.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for people that are asking, like, let's just get it over with, you have no freaking clue what you're asking for. You are asking for hell on earth. And, you know, no amount of political anger that you have, no amount of whatever disagreements you have, it is not worth that misery, and it's going to be at the home front. So meaning you can't leave and go home and go away and recoup and then come back. Like, it's all the time. It's
This is it.
So, you know, I think that's something that I, you know, as medical training or just training in general starts to become more popular, I still don't think that medical training is popular enough in this community. And it needs to be, because if we get put into that situation, you can create holes all day, but what happens when you have to plug them? And now you're forced within a situation where it's like, man, do I put this guy out of his misery? Like, he's screaming, he's being loud, like, or can I provide him the care? Do we have the necessities? And if I have those necessities, do I know how to use them properly?
So I was going to say, it's kind of a double-edged sword. I'm connected with a group on Instagram of some guys that are actually, it was a former corpsman that's been training a lot of Ukrainian guys. They'll come here, get some training, and then go back because there was so much. You know, we talked about it on the last podcast. You know, prior to the invasion, people were panicking, trying to get some sort of medical training. That's fine, but there was also a lot of bad information given. And now, what are we, 3-ish years into it? One of the big things that we're seeing is they're paying for some of that bad medical training. There's been, I just read an article about amount of unnecessary amputations because, you know, you had people teaching, you know, we could put the tourniquet on and then that's it. We can leave it, set it, forget it. But it's like, well, if that patient didn't need a tourniquet and now we have a tourniquet on their leg for 18 hours until they get somewhere of a higher echelon of care. That wound originally didn't need a tourniquet, and now they're going to lose their leg because they've had a tourniquet on for 18 hours. Just a lot of bad and misinformation that was coming out in the training realm. You know, there was, I saw some videos recently again of that rat's tourniquet making a pop up. Somebody was talking about it. I'm like, you know, that's not good information because there's zero studies that says that's a good tourniquet. So it's, let's talk about equipment and what equipment you actually need. Let's use evidence-based medicine. And America kind of led that charge because we spent 20 plus years in two wars and we did figure out what works and what doesn't work. And so we have a ton of evidence-based medicine. So I do think we actually have a little bit of responsibility as well to kind of share that information and say, hey, this is what works and this is what doesn't work. I think that's important within our community.
Yeah, I mean, especially when we're heading into 2024, man. Like,
I'm holding on tight, buddy.
Oh my gosh! Like, who knows what's going to happen? You know what I'm saying? And that's not to push fear mongering. It's to say you need to incentivize training in your life. If you're going to invest in anything, invest in your training. Because right now, like, you can, you know, investing into things that can save your life, save your family's life, make you an asset to your team has never been more important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the biggest way, in my opinion, to have a peace of mind about the unknown is knowing that I'm capable of taking care of myself and my family or my friends or being, you know, part of a team. So that way, no matter what happens, you know, we're squared away or we have really good chances.
Yeah, absolutely.
The problem is, it's like, if you have no training, well then yeah, you have a lot to be scared about because you're going to rely on somebody else to be able to take care of you.
Yeah. And that typically doesn't work in anybody's favor, relying on somebody else.
No. And that's something like, what are some more combat lessons that you think are going to apply if there was a civil conflict here? What are some scenarios that you think would be pretty realistic as far as what most people would experience?
Well, you're going to have, there's nobody to call for, right? Just as a first responder, I can tell you, I mean, if there's a fight, a fist fight that's out of control, they don't send us in, you know, before the police. And then We look at something like the Chaz situation. Like, they just said, okay, we're not going to respond to these city blocks. And that wasn't a civil war. That was just a bunch of people basically protesting and saying, this is our land, whatever. So if you have a mentality that there will be people to help you, I don't think that's a good mentality to have, because the reality is they're probably not going to send those first responders in. It's going to be on you to kind of take care of your community, your family, your neighbors. And just ask yourself, like, what are you doing to prepare for that? You know, I'd rather have the training and not need it than need it and not have it. You know, like you said, it's not necessarily fear mongering. It's the reality of the world right now. And it kind of still blows my mind that there aren't more people that kind of think this way. It could be something as simple as a hurricane. I mean, I can tell you, we don't respond when the winds get over a certain mile an hour, right? So you are on your own, just as a hurricane, and those happen. You know, we're in Florida, that happens here. So thinking that somebody's going to be there to help you is kind of naive.
You know, it's funny. I had a student of mine. He actually was, I'm going to have him on the podcast sometime, but he was at the Hurricane Katrina and he was in Louisiana. And he said, dude, like, it was a war zone down there.
That's
insane.
A prime example.
And that's like most, not very well known, like what actually happened in Louisiana, in New Orleans. Unless you're a local there and you went through it, but like, dude, there's people like in that big giant dome getting murdered in their sleep, getting robbed, raped,
crime, gunfights. I mean, legitimate gunfights
between the National Guard and regular people. Yeah. Like, that was happening on a regular basis. So like, you take away any sort of government, you take away any type of first responder, dude, it's literally like the Purge.
Yeah.
And so imagine trying to get medical attention. There ain't nobody going to help you. In fact, they're probably going to see you like, oh, he's shot. Well, what's he got? And go ahead and just take what he has. That's the type of mindset that people are probably going to have.
The sad part is it doesn't even need to be something that extreme. I don't know. Did you see any of the videos of the Ybor shooting a few weeks ago and during the Halloween?
Yeah.
I watched every video I could find on it, and it's chaos. And people just instantly rely on, okay, well, who's going to help me? And some of those injuries, you don't have time to wait on first responders. You don't have time. You know, hopefully somebody there has some training and can actually do something. But just pure chaos off of a Friday night shooting. doesn't have to be the world flipped on its head. You know, we don't want to see that either, but.
You know, in that Ybor shooting, there was a lot of chaos happening, and there, you know, people are yelling for help. I think that's something that was an interesting psychological moment to observe was it is natural for people to, as soon as a friend gets shot or as soon as a friend gets hurt or something like that, you want to help them, especially if they're a female.
Sure, sure.
For dudes, we have that natural inclination to want to do that, right? But I'm seeing it in Ukraine where guys get shot, and now after a year and a half, 2 years of combat, they're already going right to self-aid. And because nobody's coming to help them out.
Yeah.
So, and it's kind of that asset or that mindset of winning the fight, right? Of, you know, make sure that you win the fight. You're going to have to take care of yourself for a little while until somebody is able to, because there's a lull in the fight and they have created that opportunity to come help you.
Yeah. Ukraine has really, so if you're into the TACMED world at all, you know, you have those different phases. You have the acute phase where somebody immediately gets hurt. What do we need to do? Stop the bleeding. Look for chest wounds, do all that stuff. But Ukraine has really brought in the prolonged field care phase. So like, you know, OIF, OEF for our generation, we had, like you said earlier, we had so many resources. You know, I can tell you the longest we waited for a medevac in rural Helmand Province, Afghanistan, was probably about an hour. So that's pretty good. Ukraine's a different story. They just don't have the assets that we had. It seems like daily there's more information coming out about what we need to do for prolonged field care. If you have to sit on a casualty for 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, which our 18 deltas are pretty good at that. So they're definitely good resources for prolonged field care, but that's something that's really getting exploited in Ukraine right now is what do we need to change for prolonged field care to sit on a patient for days while we're waiting to get that patient out, whether they're stuck in a minefield. And we've seen that over and over again with the minefields in Ukraine. We were talking earlier about how they're now utilizing drones to drop off med supplies, you know, to units that are pinned down, whether it be a minefield or IDF or whatever it is that they're pinned down with. So they're really having to get creative with how can we treat these patients and keep them alive for longer periods of time.
I'm also seeing where we're seeing that loss of humanity, because there's this one video where it shows these two Russian dudes, two of them are dragging a wounded friend. They get him and he's in the middle of this field and they just leave him. And you can see him begging, like reaching out for him. You can see he can't walk. He's begging for them and they just leave him. And they're like, sorry. Like, and then it's either like there's prolonged field care or there's, you make hard decisions.
Yeah.
And we're seeing that. And that's something, you know, on a mental level,
I can't even imagine that. You know,
we just haven't been conditioned for that. We fought two wars, but like you said, we had medevac within an hour. Maybe in the early GWAT when it was like, okay, we have to establish a CCP in this house because it's Fallujah. Sure. But at that point in time, there's still a system in place to get guys out, get dudes in and out of the fight.
Yep.
Over there, it is just, that's why I think it is so important to study that conflict and take the lessons learned, because I feel like it will be that bloody or worse here in the States if we ever came to something like that.
Yeah. And hopefully we don't. But training and being prepared for that is super important.
Yeah. As far as the, what are some other combat lessons learned that you've heard of in that TACMED group from Ukraine, as far as like, you know, extreme amputations from, because, you know, it's not just IEDs, they're running into Soviet landmines,
yeah.
And things that are much more brutal.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, so the, you know, those patients are the ones that you will utilize the tourniquet all day, right? The traumatic amputations and things like that. But the biggest issue I read was that they're utilizing tourniquets for everything, which is kind of, it's like an approach we took with the Marines. You know, you see blood, throw a tourniquet on it. But the reason being was that a corpsman or a medic could come up after and kind of assess it. And we had the training to do a tourniquet conversion. They're not doing tourniquet conversions in Ukraine. So once the tourniquet's on, they're being taught, which is not necessarily wrong, but once it's on, it stays on. But the reality is, okay, we need to have a discussion now, because if we're talking about somebody with a tourniquet on for over 2 hours, it is going to be a problem eventually. There's going to be a bunch of acid and byproducts that build up on that limb, and it's either going to kill the limb, so they're going to get an amputation and they might not need, or they're, somebody's going to take that tourniquet off and it's going to send them into a lethal heart rhythm and they die from that. So, like I said, that prolonged care and recognizing, you know, what needs a tourniquet, what doesn't, having somebody that's trained in tourniquet conversions, as well as having the resources to do that, you know, it's kind of a, it can be a big deal, converting a tourniquet. You know, I made a post about it recently, just saying like, I probably wouldn't feel comfortable doing it after 2 hours without basic blood monitoring and or EKG monitoring, because those byproducts can cause a lethal heart rhythm instantly too. I mean, as soon as you take the tourniquet off, that buildup of myoglobin and stuff will get into the heart system and that patient will die. So that's the biggest thing that I've read, is that unnecessary amputations, everybody's getting tourniquets, which is, like I said, it's a catch 22. It's like, yeah, we want tourniquets to save lives, but if you're sitting on somebody with a tourniquet for 20 hours and then you get them evac, that's a different issue. So just real interesting stuff on the prolonged field care side of things out of Ukraine.
I'm curious, what is the ratio of the population for every 100 people, how many people are EMTs or medics?
Medics, or are they implementing what, like, my goal is with GCRC,
right?
Training everybody. Like, is everybody trained? You know, we've talked about it before. OAF, everyone got tourniquets. You know, after, you know, maybe the early 2000 initial invasion guys probably weren't rocking tourniquets, but you know, I was there in 2010 and then 2009, and everybody got tourniquets. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could be a burger flipper at the chow hall, you probably had a couple of tourniquets issued to you.
Yeah.
And again, that's the difference between our resources and theirs. I don't know what their resources look like. Do they even have the supplies to issue that amount of, you know, med gear to people? And then are they trained on it? Because training is important. It's more than just a YouTube video.
I think that, you know, there's a lot of people inside the gun community that have med kits and stop the bleed kits for initial aid. But like you were saying, the prolonged field care, I don't think that that's something that's really widely known about. So it's going to be either we rely on the EMT that's inside of your community or the nurse who happens to take, you know, interest in stopping the bleed type stuff, and them being the ones guiding the group on what to do, or start training everybody on prolonged, as many people as humanly possible, on initial stop the bleed and prolonged field care. Because, you know, how can I keep that person alive, comfortable, and safe for 24 to 36 hours until they can get to where they need to go?
And I think it's realistic to say, like, okay, if this is my community that I train with, and if crap hits the fan, these are the people I'm going to call. I think it's smart and realistic to say we have a designated medical person. That doesn't mean that that's the only person, right? Because you said everybody cross trains. You know, if you look how the special operations does it, They did 3-4 different jobs. I took that approach with my Marines. You know, I would kind of seek out the sharp ones that took interest in medicine, and I would do more in-depth training with them, because at the end of the day, I was the only corpsman. So if I got hit, you know, I needed somebody that could patch me up. So, you know, it's okay to cross train, but you should really have a designated medical person, because medical, you know, even something as simple as like a toothache, think about how bad, like the worst toothache you've ever had, that'll take you out of the fight. Yeah. Something we don't think about, you know, people don't show that in the movies, but like you go on deployment and a lot of your guys that'll go out for medical aren't necessarily like shot, you know, blown up. It's like, it's medical issues. It's, I've had diarrhea for 2 days and I can't keep anything in and I've been vomiting and, or I've been running a fever for a day. So, medical really is, it's not important until it's important. You know, that's kind of the way we see it. Because there's so many other things that'll take you out of the fight that a lot of people don't think about. I mean,
I had a motorcycle chain sprocket go through my fingernail one time and it punctured my nail bed, and I was on Percocets for a month and a half.
How bad did that hurt?
It was miserable. And so like every time that I had
a lot of nerve endings on there,
dude. So like it went through and my buddies, I was like, we got to go to the hospital right now. Like, I'm holding my finger, and I didn't even look at it. I was just like, we got to go right now. And he's like, what's going on? And then my other buddy picks up my nail. He's like, what's this? And I started throwing up, dude. Man. And
cringe.
I had to get stitches in my nail bed, no nail, in the nail bed, And then when they put gauze on it to like prevent it from sticking, every week they had to rip it off.
Yeah, you got to change it out so it doesn't build up bacteria. And
it was miserable.
Yeah,
it was absolutely miserable. But yeah, I mean, just my finger, that one finger took me out for a month and a half.
We had a guy downrange. You know, hygiene is another discussion. That's the least sexiest of the talks. But guess what?
It is important.
You get a MRSA infection.
Yeah.
This guy, they called me back to the patrol base. Take a look at this guy. He had we thought was an ingrown hair. So we dropped trowel and I take a look at it. And he had a 12-inch section of MRSA. It was like, I mean, I didn't know it was MRSA. I don't have any lab testing ability, but it was a nasty, you know, an infected area when you see it. It smelled it. It was like, dude, you have to get medevaced because one, this thing kill you if it gets in your bloodstream. Two, I imagine you don't want to do patrols with, it was kind of in the gooch area.
Oh, nice.
So I imagine you don't want to do patrols with a 12-inch section of, pus infected skin. And he got medevaced and never came back. Yeah. He required months of IV antibiotics.
So and that's again, from just not bathing.
Yeah. We didn't have, showers and stuff like that. The Marine Corps treats us a little different than the Air Force guys. So bare minimum, you know. Bare minimum when you're out there, and showers are not necessary according to them.
I mean, he didn't wet wipe himself.
Yeah, those don't quite cut it.
You know what? There's some guys, man, that just sweat dirtier. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. They just.
And then there's also guys that are just dirtier in general. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
Something to keep in mind when you're building your community.
That is honestly, that's a great point because you know you have to make it's like changing out your socks, changing out your underwear. Don't wear the same pair of underwear for freaking 4 missions and you know 8 days. Yeah. Like,
If you get a chance to shower, shower. If you get a chance to brush your teeth, brush your teeth. You know, tooth infections will kill you as well. Yeah. They can get to your heart and kill you. There's just so many crazy things in the body that'll get you that you don't think about. It's more than just a gunshot wound to the leg or, you know, losing your leg in an explosive.
So what are some crazy things that you've seen as a medic or as an EMT that you think were applicable injuries that were like, man, that just sucks, you know, in terms of like it could have been prevented type thing.
Could have been prevented. Well, I mean, I'd say like combat injuries that, you know, we can always arm, you know, Monday morning quarterback those and say we could have done this better, could have done that better. But I'd say on the civilian side, you know, as far as patients that have expired, you know, like I said, the response times are, we're not going to be there in time. So simple interventions that I like to teach people about could have at least bought them the time for us to get there and get them to the hospital. You know, I always read up on the big incidents in this country, the Pulse nightclub shooting, Boston Marathon. I love doing a case study on that.
Can we break down the Pulse nightclub actually?
We can. The big thing with the Pulse nightclub was the more on the tactical side as far as gaining entry and eliminating the threat. You know, as far as the medical side, there was a lot of injuries that definitely didn't have to cause death.
So real quick, for those who don't remember the Pulse nightclub, that happened in Orlando or it was in Orlando, Florida. Orlando. And it was what, 5 years ago?
Yeah, 5-6 years ago.
Yeah, essentially it was when ISIS was real big.
Yeah, and it was an ISIS sympathizer.
So he went into a gay club, gay nightclub, and shot. I think it was like it was a lot of people. A lot. I mean, they were all crammed in there.
Yep.
One point of entry, nightclub. Really.
Yeah.
And I mean, he
choke point. He pinned himself down in the bathroom. So, yeah. You know, as soon as he was starting to meet resistance, he essentially retreated to the bathroom. So. That would, for me, if I was in a situation like that, that's, one, I would try to eliminate the threat. But if you know if there's no more shooting going on, it's time to start seeing what you can do, moving patients off the X, which the X is where they actually got hit, trying to get an assessment, trying to see if there's any bleeding I can stop, open chest injuries, you know, I don't expect you to go to a nightclub with a chest seal in your pocket, but it is a nightclub, so I can find some Saran wrap, I can find some tape, I can find something to seal those holes off and then start moving patients out. And instead in that specific scenario, nothing was done. It was just, let's wait, let's wait, let's wait. And waiting is not the answer. On the very opposite end of that response, one of my favorites is the Boston Marathon bombing. But there's a reason that I like bringing this up, because what's crazy about the Boston Marathon bombing, so they had over 260 patients that were hit at that bomb site. I think 17 or 18 had major bleeding. There was, I'm going to screw these numbers up. I have them in my slideshow, but a handful of amputations. But here's the, there was a perfect storm with the Boston Marathon bombing. So the bombs went off near the finish line, which is where all the med tents were. So there was tons of nurses, physicians, paramedics right there, National Guardsmen, to apply tourniquets and apply life-saving aid. The hospitals, right? So the Boston, the bombs went off around 2:30, 2:45, and shift change was at 3 p.m. So there was essentially double staff in all the hospitals. Wow. Oncoming, off-going, together, they were there to actually provide aid. So, and then the other thing was the, you know, the Boston Marathon's a big deal in the city. They call it Patriots Day. And so there was no elective surgeries. So there was zero waiting for OR tables.
Wow.
So it was like a perfect, stars storm, aligned. Yeah. You know, there's three people that were killed that day. And unfortunately, those were injuries that were not sustainable with life, you know, at the blast site. But otherwise, you had over 260 patients that were saved. But what happens when that's not the case, right? Like, you know, I did a case study on it when I was finishing up my critical care training at University of Florida. And, you know, I think one thing that we would want to implement in the civilian world is on-site blood transfusions. That's something the special operations community has done for quite some time now. And I think it could possibly be applicable to a scenario like we're talking about. Like if we had a massive incident, and I'm not talking Boston Marathon, I'm talking thousands, tens of thousands of patients. That the game changes when you get to thousands of patients.
So you're talking about like maybe like, you know, blood donation centers and stuff like that.
Correct. So you know, special operations have the ability to do what's called point of care blood testing, which a lot of people I didn't realize don't know their blood type. It was weird for me because like in the military, it seems
I've met people don't even know their social security.
Yeah, they don't know their social. They don't know if they're allergic to any medicine. It's crazy. So. You know, lesson number one is you are responsible for your own safety. So maybe learn your blood type. But realistically, a medical provider is probably going to check it anyway, because it's a big deal to make sure you give the right kind of blood to somebody.
I'm going to force you down a chicken trail. What happens if you put the wrong blood in somebody?
Best case scenario, you get really, really sick. Worst case, most realistic case is you die. Blood typing is extremely important. You can even have reactions if you are getting the right kind of blood. That's the thing. You know, when you're giving blood in the medical world, we're doing temperature checks on the patient every 10 to 15 minutes for the first hour. They're constantly asking the patient, you know, how do you feel? How do you feel? How do you feel? Because you can really do a lot of damage if you give the wrong blood. So that is a big deal.
Yeah, it was a big deal enough when I was going through, like getting ready for deployment, they gave us like 15, like whatever your blood type was, you got like 15 patches.
Yep.
To just like slap that thing everywhere.
Yeah.
'Cause like, you know, if you have, like I had it written on my knee pads, on my freaking, sure. on my elbow, my helmet, anywhere I could possibly, if a limb got blown off, they could look somewhere else and see the blood type.
Sure. And knowing like if you're the big ones, like if you're O negative, which I found out in a research project that United States specifically has the biggest population of O negative blood. That's really good because O negative is universal donor. So if you know that, hey, I'm an O negative, I can help out if needed. That can make a difference in a huge scenario like that. Like, hey, we don't have enough bed spaces to transport these patients. So we need to at least get blood on board because blood is what they need at the end of the day. When we're talking about trauma, blood carries oxygen. It carries your nutrients. It's going to aid in repairing that wound. That is what they need. You know, they don't need anything else. They don't need IV bags. They need blood and surgery. So if you had a situation where we can't necessarily get this patient to a surgery table, but I can stop the bleeding and we can maybe get a liter or two of blood in this patient. Hey, I'm an O negative donor. What can I do? And there you go. Just something to think about. You know, I did a whole research project on it just to see if maybe there's an application in it. And I think something like an attack like that, the Gaza attack, or Ukraine, you know, we have thousands of patients. Resources are going to be limited fast.
Dry up very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing also is if you have blood that's stored, having the power to make sure that it is refrigerated or being able to store it properly.
Yeah. You know, it depends on which article you read, you know, but if it's not refrigerated, you usually get a day out of it. And then in a refrigerator is usually about 30 days. So either way, it's not like you can hold on to blood for years. It's not something that we can kind of preemptively load up on if we knew something was happening.
Is there any gains in maybe like artificial substitutes?
Not really, because blood carries oxygen. That's what makes the body go round and round at the end of the day is oxygen. Oxygen and CO2 out. So
yeah, because I know that for a long time, like at, you know, TCCC or CLS or whatever, it was all like IVs, like pump full of, just get some fluids in them. And what was that? I know that there's some lessons learned that actually came out of that, because that was early GWAT. That was real big. And now that's kind of changed.
That's definitely one of the biggest things we got out of the GWAT was fluid choice in hemorrhage, which the today, 2024, it's blood. They need whole blood. There are some other options like packed red blood cells and plasma and things like that, but whole blood has all your clotting factors. It has oxygen carrying capability. Early on, we were definitely utilizing IV fluids, like you see in the movies, the clear fluid. Problem with that is it's one, it doesn't carry oxygen. That's the answer at the end of the day, is it carries zero oxygen. But it also dilutes blood. It dilutes your clotting factors. It's extremely acidotic, which when somebody starts bleeding out, they're going to kind of shift into an acidotic state. So you're going to kind of speed that process up. So like even now we teach medics at the end of the day, it might be better to let them be a little on the low blood pressure side versus getting fluids in and trying to get that blood pressure up. We call it permissive hypotension, meaning you're kind of allowing the body to just remain at a relaxed state. We have numbers that we need to measure and see and make sure the brain is getting perfused and the heart and the kidneys, but it's not like something is better than nothing case. It's actually sometimes nothing is better. Let that patient have a low blood pressure until we can get blood products on board.
Wow. Yeah. That's, you know, something that I know that was a big deal. And I remember when we went back to training, we're like, how come we're not doing IVs anymore? Mm-hmm. And it makes sense. And there's always gains and there's always improvements happening in the medical world. So I think that's also important for, you know, how important is it for medical guys? Like say, for example, a dude who was a corpsman back in the day or used to be a nurse or an EMT, how pertinent it is for them to make sure that they're staying up to date on.
So that's a great point. That's the best point I've heard you bring up because just because we have this is not my saying, I'm stealing it from our old medical director at the college that I taught at, but he used to tell the graduating paramedic students, you know, in the last year, you learn a lot of medicine and 50% of what you learned is wrong. We just don't know which 50% is. So medicine changes so often. Things like Ukraine happening right now, OIF, OEF changed the game on so many levels. So you do have to be careful of somebody that like was in the game 10, 15 years ago, really 5 years ago. It's like, hey, I was a medic 5 years ago and I haven't done it since. It's like, oh, a lot has changed, you know, medicine changes it at an insane rate. You know, and it's usually for the good. You do have to stay up to date on it. You know, that's the one thing like as an active paramedic and somebody that's getting into critical care, you know, evidence-based medicine means you're constantly reading articles. You're constantly looking at what the standard of care is. What are we supposed to be doing for this kind of patient? Traumatic amputations, gunshot wounds, you know, pneumothoraxes. What's the standard of care? What should we be doing? Because it does change, you know, it changes pretty often.
What are some of the, I know we hit up before on the YouTube episode, which if you guys haven't seen, go check out the YouTube episode we did with Todd about IFAC loadout. But real quick, for those who haven't seen it, what are some basic necessities you need to have in your individual first aid kit on your belt or on your body armor that you have on your go stuff?
So on your person are the things that are going to get you quick, right? The things that will cause you to die within minutes. So we're talking tourniquets without a doubt. And I do say plural. I live by the two is one is none saying, and tourniquets, I'm going to reiterate tourniquets that are tested and approved and have evidence that back them. I don't endorse a single brand of tourniquet. I can tell you what I carry, which is the Cat tourniquet, and I like the Sam XT tourniquet. Both are TCCC approved, but there's just some bad information that's kind of floated up recently about you don't need this, you don't need that. Just stick to evidence-based medicine. So tourniquets, gauze for packing, and I say specifically for packing because there are loose 4x4 gauze you can get. We don't want to jam those into holes. If we're going to be jamming something into a human body, we want it one continuous strand of gauze. So packing gauze. Preferred is hemostatic, so something like combat gauze or Celox. But again, if that's not out of your, if that's not in your budget, those things are expensive. I'm not going to lie to you. So if all you can afford is regular traditional gauze that's meant for packing, that is sufficient. I'd say some sort of pressure dressing, because with packing a wound, you're going to have to add pressure into that. It doesn't negate the need for pressure. So some sort of pressure dressing, whether it be an Israeli defense bandage, H bandage, or just a simple ACE wrap. You come through my course, I'll show you how to make a pressure dressing out of that. And then chest seals. You know, chest seals, any kind of hole in the chest is something that we need to seal up sooner rather than later, because this is a negative pressure area. So when you put a hole in it, pressures are going to equalize, and then eventually the pressure is going to get higher in your chest than outside, which is a problem. So chest seals, gauze. I also always add in a marker. Markers, you know, you got your little Sharpie holder, you get Rock at the Range.
We actually have the Milwaukee holster that we're actually about to bring out, and that was actually based off of the guests or the members and stuff like that in the community that were like, hey, Milwaukee, that marker, you can mark it on wet things, you can mark it on any surface, where Sharpie's kind of finicky. So we'll actually have those on the website soon.
Yeah, a marker, right? One, it's really useful on your range day, especially for me. I can plot all my shots in my group. That's no, I'm just kidding.
Trash.
And then two, you know, you really do want to try to document things that you've done. So, hey, I put a tourniquet on, especially, you know, low light environments, you miss stuff. I promise you, you're going to miss something. So it's way easier for me to roll up and see that this guy has written on his chest, two tourniquets, both legs. You know, I gave him some water or whatever, you know, just being able to document. And then I also always add in some sort of trauma shears. I've noticed a lot of the shooters, they like carrying trauma shears. Those are pretty sexy looking on your kit. But I'm going to throw in the caveat to really focus on buying good quality trauma shears. Amazon sells some like $12 ones, and you'll go to use them and they'll just like, the blades will just like split open and not cut anything. So if you're going to rock trauma shears, I recommend investing in a good pair. I like the X shears or the Leatherman Raptors,
which he got me for Christmas.
Yeah.
And they're really freaking nice.
Yeah.
So actually, I think I have.
The Raptors full up to about. Yeah, there you go. So.
Super nifty.
They're expensive, but they're worth every penny. I can tell you that. I know everybody in the flight world, a lot of guys on the pre-hospital EMS world are rocking those. Those are the ones I use in Afghanistan. They get the job done. And then the last thing I would say in an IFAC is thermal protection, because they're small and there's no reason that we can't put like five little tiny space blankets in your IFAC. Again, I can go into the details when you come through my course about why that's super important to make sure your bleeding patients are warm.
What are some of the things that we've seen as trends with the students that come through the course? What are some trends that you've seen that usually students miss, because there is a final scenario in the course, so we don't want to talk about all the secrets of that. But what are some things that you notice that students do that are trending?
You know, it's a crawl, walk, run class. That's kind of how we built it. So the crawling is the lecture. You stay awake for that. Cool. And then the walking phase is we break up and do skills. You know, and the skills section is really on the student. You know, if they tell me, hey, we're good, I get it, then we're going to move on. If they want to spend 2 hours on it, we'll spend 2 hours on it. But it's really getting familiar with making those pressure dressings, utilizing them, wound packing, getting a tourniquet on. We throw in a little bit of this, you know, you throw somebody on a shot timer with the tourniquet and they start getting a little fumbled. And that's okay. We'll keep running those until it's clean. Because if there is a time when you're a little bit more stressed than usual, you're going to fall back to your training. So how proficient are you with your fine motor skills and grabbing that tourniquet and getting it in place, putting it in the right place? You know, a little bit of stress, sometimes you see some silly things. Like in training, when we're doing the walking phase, they're doing tourniquets perfect, tight, right location. They're telling me, yep, this is 2 to 3 inches above the wound, bleeding's controlled, all this. And then a little bit more stress on top of that, and you see some funky things, tourniquets on elbows, tourniquets on the wrist. You're like, whoa, what happened, dude?
Yeah, it's like I see when I teach shooting, grips all jacked up and look like a freaking Hollywood movie.
Yeah. So I'd say that's the most consistent thing is utilize, if you come through, utilize the skills portion to really dial in the skills. Just like any barrel and hatchet class, I'm giving you tools that you can take with you to go train somebody else, practice on your own. And it is perishable, just like shooting. So that's why you take classes, right? You learn drills, different techniques that you should work on. It's no different on the medical thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a great way to, if you have a skill set that you want to enforce and you want to like ingrain it in your mind, show it to people. Like, show what you just learned. We did that a lot at the unit. And we still do, but we would send several people to a course and they would come back and they were supposed to teach us what they learned to help reinforce one for them, but also expose everybody else to the information. It's kind of more the best bang for your buck, if you
will. Well, the very last thing I talk about in that lecture portion is you know, if you really enjoyed the course, please recommend somebody to come through it. But really, I'm in the business of saving lives. So, you know, show your neighbor, show your family member everything you learned here. And if you like the course enough to recommend it, great, awesome. I appreciate that. But my goal is to prevent, you know, people from dying during these incidents, car accidents, you know, active shooters, terrorist attacks, Roy's fishing story on the boat. You know, it doesn't matter. That's my goal is not to be, you know, some guy that wants to be a millionaire off this stuff. I want people to survive these incidents. That's what my whole purpose in life is. So,
well, I mean, you know, training becomes invaluable when it comes time to actually have to use it. So, it's one of those things where, man, this year, who knows what's coming. And training is the only comfort of mine besides, you know, being right spiritually, mentally, but having the abilities to be able to be competent and to be an asset, that's going to give you peace of mind. So yeah, I think that don't rely on other people to help you out, you know, make sure you can try and take care of yourself.
I hope I'm wrong, but I think at the very least this year, we will probably see a little bit more civil unrest, at the very least. And again, please prove me wrong, America, you know, because at the end of the day, we are all Americans and we're in this together. So, but I want to at least be prepared for if that happens, you know, keeping me and my circle safe and those around me.
Nice. Well, so what are some ways that people can find you? And, you know, if they have questions about things that they heard here on the podcast, how can they reach you?
Yep. I tell my students this too. Anytime they come through a class, if you ever have questions, you can always DM me. Pretty good at getting back to people. If I don't have an answer, I will never BS you. I will get the answer or utilize my resources to get the right answer. But I'm on Instagram, guardian_angel_consulting. And then again, if you can't find me on there, you can always reach out to Eric through Barrel and Hatchet. But again, I love running that Instagram page. It's like a therapeutic thing for me. I like posting different articles, different cases. I've done quizzes for swag giveaways, which are always fun. So I look forward to growing this community.
Nice. Well, guys, make sure you guys go out there. And if you want to sign up for a course, you can check the newsletter or also check the website. Newsletter is going to have the most up-to-date schedules. We do post those monthly. So make sure you go and invest in yourself. Even pay for a friend to go through training. But make sure you invest in yourself. Nonetheless, make sure you're the asset, not the liability, and we'll see you on the next one.